When the well-known fire chief of a small mountain community goes missing in the early 2000s, no one suspected how many twisted pieces his story would hold. You're listening to Cold Brew, a true crime podcast fueled by Cold Brew Coffee. I'm your host, Caitlin Brewer, and if you like what you hear, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can find me on social media at Cold Brew Crime to see images related to this episode. Finally, welcome to episode number 10 of Cold Brew. It's been a long time coming. I know. I literally know. Despite my extended absence, it feels so good to be back in front of the microphone. And I do want to say thank you to all of those who sent some words of encouragement during my very long break. I know I scared a few of you into thinking I would never return, but have no fear. I am here. I am back. I am in a much more casual recording setup than I have normally been. I'm actually on my bed and I am pregnant and very out of breath. So if I sound a little more gasping for air, that would be why. Since the last episode, my family and I have moved into our new home, hence me sitting on my bed. We've settled into new jobs, celebrated the holidays, shared that we are expecting a new baby girl this year, and we are currently recovering from COVID. Yes, the COVID. So much life has happened in just a few short months, and my cup is overflowing with gratitude for my health and all the happiness I have found in this new chapter of life. I hope you are all well and still staying safe out there. I know 2021 has been just as crazy as 2020, but here's to hoping for brighter days ahead. Now, for the moment you have all been patiently waiting for, I am going to announce the giveaway winner. In case you all forgot, there's still a giveaway I have to announce. I released the first episode of Cold Brew in April of 2020 with absolutely no idea what I was doing, or how to use any of this equipment, or how to make it happen on a computer, much less on the internet into the network of podcasts. I still really don't know that much, but thanks to all of you, I didn't stop after the first episode. Creating a podcast takes a lot of work, for little to no return, might I add. And these aren't exactly lighthearted topics that I'm researching over here, so I truly mean it when I tell you that your reviews, kind words, social media shares, merchandise purchases, whatever it may be, they legit mean the world to me, and they are the reason that I am here recording once again. So thank you. It is my pleasure to announce that the winner of the giveaway, winning a free Cold Brew True Crime t-shirt and a sticker, is LCook116. Congratulations. Please reach out to me on social media to claim your prize. And again, thank you all that entered. Stay tuned for another t-shirt and sticker sale soon. As much as I would love to share an awesome Cold Brew Coffee with you today on this episode, sadly I will not be able to taste it. Even if I had one, I wouldn't be able to taste it. So on top of that, I wouldn't be able to get out of my home to go get it unless somebody had already mailed it to me, which they have not. And I'm recording this at 10:30 p.m., so my coffee intake has already been maxed out for the day, and I want to sleep tonight. So I am so sorry, but I can tell you the coffee I have been drinking. Drinking coffee without taste or smell is the absolute worst. Like, it's literally, I don't even know. But to keep things on a brighter note, I am super excited to reach out to some more local coffee shops to sample their cold brews. So if you do have a hookup to a coffee shop, please let me know. I'm still drinking, regular hot coffee daily. I believe it's Maxwell House Blend, So shout out to Maxwell House and buying in bulk. My husband and I both drink coffee every morning, so we purchased the largest, cheapest container of coffee possible. We occasionally might have a reserve fancy coffee, but the chances are very unlikely. So please feel free to tag at Cold Brew Crime in your favorite coffee shop social media post so I can find some new cold brews to try. I think that's all the housekeeping I have for today. Keeping it pretty short and sweet. I'll be back with the case right after this. So I had to do one more local case before I venture out into the great unknown. So I will once again be in Western North Carolina for this episode. A wonderful listener, also by the name of Caitlin, spelled the same, suggested this case to me on multiple occasions, and once I finally took a minute to Google it, I was shocked. This case takes us to Hendersonville, North Carolina, more specifically the towns of Etowah and Horseshoe. This area is still considered a part of the Blue Ridge Mountains, but it sits just south of Asheville and borders South Carolina. The first things that come to my mind when I think of Hendersonville and Henderson County are apples, beer, and waterfalls. Henderson County is one of the 10 largest apple-producing counties in the whole U.S. They have an apple festival every Labor Day, and it is lit. Like, if you want to have a good time, go on over to this apple festival. Hendersonville is also home to Sierra Nevada's East Coast headquarters, so if you're ever in the area, I highly recommend checking it out. They have a huge outdoor seating area with cornhole boards and fire pits. It's so much fun in the summer, and you can also tour the whole facility during the day and see how they do what they do. There's also Bold Rock Hard Cider just down the road, which is another awesome experience and my personal fave. Of course, there are also a ton of waterfalls and hiking trails in the area to enjoy, just like the rest of Western North Carolina. I give it a 10 out of 10 for Hendersonville. When I first started researching this case, I realized that my sister lives approximately 7 miles from the crime scene. Even though she didn't live there at the time of the crime, just knowing someone with a personal connection to the area got me even more curious about the case, because it's so much easier to visualize once I've actually been there and know the location. In March of 2004, Donald Larry Gash, better known as Don, was 48 years old and the fire chief of the Etowah Horseshoe Volunteer Fire Department. He was a very well-known member of his community, and from what I read, his only other source of income at this time was raising cattle for slaughter on his family's 22-acre farm. Don was married to his high school sweetheart, Gail, who was 2 years older than him. Together, they had 2 children, Donald Jr., who was in his early 30s at the time and still lived at home, and their daughter, Leslie, who was in her late 20s but did not live at home. Some sources say that Leslie stopped by often to check on her brother and that she had a close relationship with her mom, but I truly could not find that much information about her. I do not know where she lived at this time or like if she was in school or anything of the nature. So I don't feel like I can confirm or deny her position in the family. So I do want to give some detailed background information of this family before we really get into the case, because I feel like it's crucial to understanding any of this. So just bear with me as I lay this out for you. All right, Don and Gail got married in June of 1972 when they were 18 and 17 years old. At that time, Gail was already 5 months pregnant with their son, who was born in October. And that same year, Gail's father died also, leaving Gail primarily responsible for her mother's well-being. Gail's mother moved into a trailer close by the Gash's residence, and over the next few years, she would struggle with grief and depression from the loss of her husband. Because who wouldn't? This is just the beginning of this couple's married life, and it is already off to a very rocky start. They seemed to push through those early years, and they continued to establish themselves in the community. Nearly a month after Don Jr. was born, Gail took a job with Kimberly Clark and worked there for a few years until she left to return home and stay with her son. While Don, the husband, was regularly employed during this time, she felt like she could comfortably stay home to spend time with her very young son. Gail did return to work in the customer service industry in 1984, but quit within that same year after the death of her mother. Gail's mother died from smoke inhalation from a fire that happened in her trailer that was near the Gash's residence. Don was able to remove Gail's mother from the fire, but unfortunately the injuries were still too large for her to overcome. Gail witnessed this whole thing, and I can only imagine how traumatic this must have been for her, like literally standing there watching your mother's home burning in flames and feeling totally helpless. And then your husband goes in and you're terrified of the whole situation. So following her mother's death in June of 1985, Gail was admitted to the ICU following a suicide attempt. She remained unemployed for the next 2 years and continued to receive outpatient psychiatric care to help cope with the loss of her mother. By 1986, Gail was on the up and up. She found a job as a legal assistant at a law firm in Hendersonville, and she also began taking classes at the University of North Carolina in Asheville. Just as it seemed like Gail and the family were finally getting back on their feet, Don found out he had a spinal cord tumor. I am not 100% sure what Don's job was at this time. I'm assuming it's the same job he had been working since the beginning of their marriage, and a few sources noted heavy machinery was involved, so basically the pain of his back while trying to work was just too much, so he inevitably had to apply for disability and leave his job. Even though Don was now on disability, he remained very active with the local fire department. Like I mentioned, Don was the fire chief of the Etowah Horseshoe Volunteer Fire Department. I was not able to determine whether he was actually paid for this position back in 2004 or ever for that matter, but the current fire chief is one of 4 paid staff employees and they have roughly 35 volunteer members today. There are 4 stations within this fire department that cover all of Etowah and Horseshoe, and overall, this fire department sets a very high standard among volunteer fire departments and rescue stations in North Carolina. It is obvious that they take extreme pride in what they do, and they contribute greatly to their community. While continuing to serve as the fire chief, Don also began devoting more time to raising cattle on the family's property with the hopes that it would generate some revenue. However, Gail did state in an interview that enterprise was never profitable. It's at this time in their lives that the family began experiencing financial difficulties, which ultimately led to the beginning of marital problems for Don and Gail. By 1991, Gail had finished her bachelor's degree in psychology and had taken a job with the Henderson County Department of Social Services. There, she was an income maintenance caseworker. She kept this job until 1994 and then took a job as the executive director of the Humane Society. Like, for real, this lady's job history is all over the place. No surprise, but in 1995, she went back to DSS as a caseworker, but resigned a year later because of what she described as the food stamp fiasco. Basically, she was accused of creating fraudulent accounts for whoever, but her side of the story claims that she only did it so one of her clients would not be without benefits, like because of a malfunction in the system. So now, in 1996, Gail is hired as a secretary to the president of a local dairy processing plant. So she's like done with DSS. So she's this guy's secretary, and the financial stress at home was at an all-time high. Don didn't want to return to work because he was afraid he would lose his disability. This resulted in Gail inevitably stealing money from her employer. Naturally, Gail gets caught and pleads guilty. She is then sentenced to 5 years probation and ordered to pay back her employer for all the money she took. So this all brings us to 2004. Dawn is on disability at home. Gail is working her butt off to pay back her employer and also trying to bring home some money so they can survive. On Friday, March 26, 2004, Judy Gash called Randy Baker and asked if he had heard from his friend Dawn. Judy was Dawn's cousin's wife. Okay? Judy was Dawn's cousin's wife. And apparently, these two were very close friends and communicated with each other often. Judy clearly had a reason to be concerned about Dawn's whereabouts. Judy and Randy mutually shared these concerns as neither of them could get in touch with Dawn. He wasn't calling them back. He wasn't answering. They called the Henderson County Sheriff's Department and they told them to go talk with Gail. So, you know, these two had already done that, and Gail was the least concerned about her husband's whereabouts when they asked where he was. But they did say she was very anxious and pretty much wanted them to leave. So later, Gail would claim she had been in contact with Dawn and that she couldn't make it all out because there was some phone static, but it sounded like something about a cow. You know, he would be home later in the evening, so she wasn't concerned. The sheriff department ends up going to the Gash's residence at South Rugby Road in Horseshoe on Saturday, March 27th, to do a welfare check on Dawn. Dawn Jr. would later testify that he was very alarmed when the police arrived in the early morning hours on that Saturday. He realized then that neither his father or mother was home, and he was just really confused about what was happening. He gave the deputies permission to search the property, not the home, and just assumed his mother would be home soon to clear everything up. It was during this first search that the deputies, located the car that Dawn was assumed to be driving. It was parked on the property. It was a silver Dodge Neon, and the keys were in the ignition and in the on position. The deputies did not do much searching during this initial check. I'm sure they assumed there was a logical explanation for everything and that Dawn would show up soon. I am still, however, really confused as to why they went to the house so early in the morning. From my understanding from articles I read, it was like 3 or 4 in the morning. And I don't know. I guess they assumed he would definitely be there sleeping if he was, you know, totally fine. So they had a good chance of finding him there at that time. I don't know. Regardless, they come back. The deputies come back a second time that evening around 7 to do another search. It's like, would they not come in the daylight? I don't know why they're doing this all at nighttime. That evening, Sheriff Deputy Kenneth Gady discovers a human torso in a large plastic container beside the barn behind the Dodge Neon. He testified later in court that he noticed like a purple blanket over top of this, you know, container. And when he flipped it back with his flashlight, there was a charred human torso underneath. Okay, so apparently they have found part of Dawn. After this extremely bizarre discovery, there are still no physical signs of Gail. At this point, they think Gail could possibly also be in danger. No one knows where she is. Randy Baker, the friend who originally reported Dawn missing, calls in a suspicious, like, small red car the next day that was sitting abandoned at the local cemetery. It had been there for an extended period of time. And Randy definitely seems to be the type of guy to be on, you know, like, the community watch team. He's on high alert, knowing that now a human torso has been found on the Gash property. Like, he's ready to get someone. So sure enough, after the red car is traced, it turns up that it belongs to the son, Don Jr. And of course, he had no knowledge of the car's whereabouts when questioned. At this point, Don is presumed dead. Gail is, again, nowhere to be found, and Don Jr. is literally clueless to anything that is happening. On Monday, March 28th, 4 days after Don was reported missing, the sheriff's department gets a call from a Buncombe County park ranger that's working up on the Blue Ridge Parkway. If I've not said this before, I feel like I need to say it now for those who don't know. The Blue Ridge Parkway is this beautiful drive that goes from the bottom of North Carolina all the way to the top of Virginia. It is America's longest linear park and stretches across 469 miles. This whole drive is dotted with breathtaking views and outdoorsy activities. You know, it's pretty to just drive on, but you can also, like, do stuff. I absolutely love the parkway and will go on any given day if you want to. So, this park ranger legitimately finds human remains wrapped up in trash bags just scattered along the parkway. Like, someone literally threw these bags out of their window like trash, and there are human body parts inside of them. I'm sorry. What? And sure enough, they were Dawn. All right, at this point, like, somebody legit needs to find Gail. Clearly, she is hiding somewhere, or she is basically dead herself. No one knows. Somebody needs to get her. I truly cannot imagine what this little community of Etowah and Horseshoe is doing during this time. Like, they're small towns. People do not show up dismembered on a daily basis. And, you know, it doesn't actually matter that they were small towns, any size of town. When bodies are found dismembered, that is disturbing. So everybody's on the lookout for Gail. Finally, on Wednesday, she is found by a neighbor. She is wrapped in a sheet and laying on the ground in a crawl space of a shed on a neighbor's property. Crazy. She told paramedics she'd been there since 4:30 a.m. on Saturday. And I think at this point, it's obvious that somebody needs to get Gail some help. Sis has been lying on the ground for 5 days with nothing but a sheet. The next day, on Thursday, April 1st, 2004, at 2 a.m., clearly the sheriff's department likes to catch people off guard, a search warrant was executed at the Gash's residence. So this is the first time any deputies have actually been able to go inside since Dawn went missing. During the search, investigators discovered that a fold-out, like, pull-out couch in the residence was covered with blood, hair, and flesh. There were blood spatter patterns on the walls and ceiling, as well as the bathtub and on the back of a door. They also found an animal carcass in a standalone freezer. Don Jr. told the police that it was to prevent his dogs from fighting over it. So, I mean, I don't know what type of animal it was, like a rabbit, a cat, a chicken. Do not know, but, I mean, they did have cattle on their property on this farm. So, technically, I feel like this isn't, like, the farthest fetched thing for a farm to do. I don't know. So it comes up later that they also found a lot of disturbing material in Don Jr.'s room. Apparently, he is an avid writer, particularly in the horror and homicide genre and body dismemberment. So, like, that's sketchy and suspicious. After this search was concluded, Gail was arrested later that day while in the hospital, where she had been since they found her the day before. She was charged with first-degree murder of her husband and placed in the Henderson County Jail under no bond. By August of 2004, Gail was officially indicted with first-degree murder. The case would be followed out non-capitally, which meant Gail would be spared from facing the death penalty. Over the next 2 years, Gail remains in jail, and in August of 2006, her defense attorney tried to get the venue changed, you know, like to another courthouse, but it was ruled that the case would remain in Henderson County. Jury selection ended up getting postponed on November 6th, but on the following day, on November 7th, 2006, Gail pleaded guilty to second-degree murder for the crime that occurred on March 24th, 2004, with a plea bargain to follow. So to clarify, she was charged with first-degree murder, but pleaded guilty to second-degree. The difference between the two is basically whether it was a premeditated act or not, and second-degree having a lesser sentence. Gail Hutchinson Gash was sentenced to a minimum of 15 years in prison for murder in the second degree of her husband, Donald Larry Gash. Autopsy results would show that Don died from blunt force trauma to the head. His head and limbs were cut off using, quote, precision butcher tools with fine, sharp edges, unquote, and his torso was reportedly covered in soot and carrying degrees of charring. It was also later released that a bloodstain, sheet, tarp, and rope had been burned on the property. Many people believe that Don Jr. played a role in his father's murder, and the local sheriff's department obviously had their suspicions as well. They did receive conflicting stories about where Don Jr. had been on March 24th, and they did send off his fingerprints for testing, but he was never formally charged with any crimes associated with his father's death. There was also a forensic search done on the family's computer that showed Don Jr. had a routine of nightly computer use. His routine had been broken on March 24th and 25th, around the time that the medical examiner believed that Don had been murdered. But again, in the end, Don Jr. maintained his innocence. Okay, so let that all sink in real quick as I take the world's deepest breath. Normally, I don't have anything else to share at this point. Like, that's it. That's the end of the story. And we rarely find out what actually happened or how the crime took place. You know, the events that happened after. We're usually just left to theorize ourselves and basically make it up. This one, however, is different. While waiting for trial, Gail was evaluated by forensic psychiatrist George P. Corbin. The evaluation was then submitted to the court by Gail's defense attorney and John Harbin, a staff writer for the Times News in Hendersonville, wrote an article in November of 2006 summarizing the evaluation. And it's nuts. We get to hear firsthand from Gail what actually happened that night, according to her. So later on in this interview, after discussing her life, you know, like her history and her family and such, Gail is finally asked about the circumstances and the events that led to her arrest. She said that the state believed her and her son had killed her husband for financial gain. She totally denied that that was what happened. She then begins to discuss her husband's long-standing affair with Judy Shuford Gash. Remember Judy? The wife of Don's cousin? The one who reported him missing? Well, apparently that was his girlfriend. So, according to Gail, Don and Judy met in 1986. They became, quote, best friends, but later became romantically involved. Gail said she had suspected the relationship for a long time before even confronting Don about it. Of course, he denied it. And in 2000, she overheard a phone conversation between the two of them, Judy and Don, and she later learned that they had spent the night together in Myrtle Beach. I don't know any more than that. So for Gail, this was total confirmation that these two were basically romantically involved. Gail continued to say that she cared for her husband and did not want to hurt him, but in reality had stopped loving him a long time ago. When she brought up the idea to Don of divorce once upon a time, he basically freaked out and broke through a door and cut his foot on glass. So that did not go over well. Gail shared that she had a hip surgery in 2000, and after that, the couple began to sleep in separate rooms. Don slept on the fold-out sofa bed in the living room, and Gail stayed in the bedroom. Gail said that over the last 15 years of their marriage, sex had been irregular or non-existent, and that Don often forced himself on her. She went on to discuss that Don had a few alcohol-induced violent streaks over the course of their marriage, and he had hit her with the back of his hand on a few occasions. So once she was asked about her husband's death, she claims her memory is incomplete on that night. She starts by saying she remembers going down to their barn around 7 p.m. to tell Don that dinner was ready, but they had no, like, real contact or communication with each other for the rest of the night until she hears him pick up his keys. She knew he had been drinking, and she told him that if he left, she would call the sheriff. And Don, obviously being the community figure that he was, that would just be a no. He could not do that. So after that, she said he threw down the keys, probably annoyed at her, and just went to sit on the couch. And, you know, that was that. Gail says she recalls her son, Don, going to bed around 11 p.m. that night, and at that time, she got on the computer to do some research on alcohol abuse that she had planned to show her husband, Don. She believes she stayed on the computer until like 3 a.m., which she said was not unusual for her. Around 3 a.m., Gail says that she goes back into the living room to check on the wood-burning stove before going to bed herself. And Don, who I guess was still awake or woke up when she went in there, asked her to come over and sit by him on the pull-out couch. She said once she sat down, he awkwardly started rubbing her hand and asked her if she wanted to do it. At this point, she pretty much just laughed and said that things began to escalate rather quickly and that he forced himself on her and proceeded to rape her. She added that this was exceptionally painful due to her previous hip injury and that he was very rough. Gail believes that some arguing took place, and the next thing she remembers was being held face down on the sofa and barely being able to breathe. He hit her on the back of the head with something at some point, and Gail continued to describe the struggle, and she said she managed to break one arm free and just like flung herself towards the hearth. She managed to grab a small log and ended up hitting Don over the head with it, but it did knock him out. So she was like, crap, okay, what do I do now? The altercation continued, and Gail said she doesn't remember anything at that point until Don was lying on his back. She recalls being able to hear like snoring sounds and noises, but they sounded wet, like coming from him. And then she realized she saw blood coming from his nose and ear. She immediately went to run out of the house, like to escape. But she said once she opened the door, she thought, like, where am I going to go? So she returned inside. At this point, she noticed that her husband had urinated on himself and his body looked lifeless. So she assumes he's dead and was like, crap, I cannot let my son wake up and see this. And she claims that all this was at 3:30 a.m. So she begins to drag her husband out of the living room in stages. In stages as in she dragged him to the kitchen, probably took a break because she was probably, you know, there was a lot of work. And then onto the back porch, then down some steps. And at this point, she goes back inside to clean up. And then, you know, eventually goes back and wraps his body in a tarp. She says she goes to bed around 6:45 a.m. And over the next few hours, however long it was, as time passes, she like realizes she legit needs to get this body out of their home. And also Gail is like a fairly small human. Like she's not a bodybuilder by any means. This is gonna be hard for her to do, to remove this body, okay? So in desperation, the only way she could think to remove the body of Don was to cut it up. So after doing this, she was still unable to move the torso because it was still probably really heavy. So she tried to burn it. After this failed attempt to burn the torso, she places it in a plastic container and just leaves it near the barn. She then placed her husband's head and other extremities in separate plastic bags and just drives to the Blue Ridge Parkway to dispose of them, tosses them out the window like it's no big deal. On Gail's way back to the house, she sees blue lights and multiple vehicles parked near the barn on the property. Obviously, she's sketched out. This is when she abandons her son's car at the cemetery. And she walks into the woods and basically just wanders until she finds herself at her neighbor's house and just crawls in the crawl space and lays there until she's found and taken into custody. So that is Gail's side of the story. Whether you choose to believe it or not, that's what she claims happened. And with all of that being said, the family, as in Gail and Don Jr., and I guess Leslie, are still claiming that Don Jr. had absolutely nothing to do with any of this, and that he is and was totally clueless as to what happened. Like, no literal way. I'm sure if he, in fact, was living in the house, like, he had to sense something. Like, did you not smell straight bleach in your home when you walked in? Were you not like, oh my gosh, what are you doing in here? And regardless of whether seeing his mother like every evening was common or not, I just still feel like he should have realized something was weird. And if he said like he was legit asleep in the house that night at 11 p.m., did you not hear anything? Really? I don't believe it. I'm sorry. Gail 100% took all the blame for this, but there's no way she committed this crime totally by herself. I do not believe it. While serving her time, Gail died in 2010 from natural causes at the age of 56. She had been in prison for nearly 6 years at the time of her death. Clearly, this family had a lot more than financial issues. And I just can't help but wonder, what would have happened if Gail had just picked up the phone and dialed 911 moments after she realized Don was dead. According to her story, technically she acted in self-defense, right? Cold Brew is written, recorded, edited, and produced by me, Caitlin Brewer. To be sure you don't miss future episodes, please subscribe to Cold Brew True Crime Podcasts wherever you listen. You can send any questions or comments about this episode to me on social media at Cold Brew Crime, and don't forget to tag me on your favorite coffee shop social media. It feels so good to be back with you guys, even though I'm really out of breath. Thank you all again, just for being so patient and so supportive. I'll be back soon.